Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akio, and if you're interested in how organizations influence behavior, this episode is for you. Joining me today is Sjors de Boeck. He transitioned from behavioral economy, and he's now a solution architect over at Rabobank. Very cool. I'll put all his socials in the description below. Check him out. And with that being said, enjoy our episode. Beyond coding. It feels like we have a baby, because right now, whenever we go to bed, my girlfriend and I, the neighbors have now a kid, and the kid is screaming in the middle of the night, crying like it's probably a few months old, and it's like it sleeps with the window open. It's like it's right next door, basically. Yeah. So my girlfriend's like, nah, no kids yet, just because she's like, no, you get up.
I mean, it sounds scary, and things like these they might demotivate you a bit from like getting a kid, but at that point. Yeah, sometimes it's really rough, but you also have these really nice moments that make up all the bad stuff.
Yeah.
Not saying that you should walk out of the studio and get started. Yeah. Just saying that sometimes the things that seem really scary or seem really annoying tend to be a lot less when it is actually the case. And sometimes the things that seem really minor, they tend to be quite challenging. Yeah. So it's a roller coaster. Yeah, that's the only thing I can tell you. And every kid is different. Every parent is different. So it's always a challenge, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. Be careful when you go with your hands on the table, by the way. Otherwise, it's fine. Recording's already running. I was wondering how you got into kind of behavioral psychology. Because, I mean, even how you described the behavior of your kid, it's specific to behavior. Mm-hmm. And you're recognizing your own behavior in them. I like behavior. How did you get kind of interested in that in the first place?
Yeah, so when I was, I studied economics.
Yeah.
And in my bachelor's program, we had a course on behavioral economics, which was a really nice course. And it showed me that everything we're doing as economists doesn't always fit in models. Mm. At least we try to put everything in models, but we need to make a lot of assumptions. And some of these assumptions make a lot of sense. Because when you try to abstract something in a model, you try to take away the stuff that doesn't really matter. But it should still make sense in like a general sense when you're designing this model. So in this behavioral economics course, they explained to me that sometimes the assumptions we make in these models might not be realistic. Mm. So in a lot of traditional economic models, they say that people are fully rational. And if you have enough people, that at a certain point we converge to rationality.
Yeah.
Which is an easy assumption. Mathematically, it makes a lot of sense and you can model stuff really neatly. But it doesn't always make sense. Mm. And I spent more time with behavioral economics in my master's. So when I was graduating, I wrote my thesis on how can we help self-employed people to start saving for their retirement if they want. And that was really nice because you have so many expectations based on what you've learned in the past years. And a lot of them were wrong. So in a sense.
Plain and simple.
Yeah. So you're confronted. And the nice part is that you have a lot of research done on how people behave and how people react to certain stuff. But if you try to replicate those studies, then sometimes they don't make sense because of cultural differences. Some people react differently. And then it also motivated me that, okay, we might not have a general truth saying that if we want to do this, then it's not deterministic saying that if we do this with the person A, response will be B. But it showed me that we need to experiment.
Yeah.
We need to try stuff. And if you try more stuff, then you can see the result and then you can move forward with doing other new stuff. So I think that was the best lesson I got from studying economics, that it's nice to abstract stuff. It makes sense. It makes easier to explain things.
Yeah.
But the behavioral side gave a lot more body to the things I've learned. And also that doing experiments and trying things makes a lot of sense because the things we know might not always be the case in our specific context. And after I started working, so I first got a job as a macroeconomist. I wanted to do more on the customer behavior side, which I think is really interesting. But working in a large corporation, it's difficult because I might want to do a lot of experiments. It sounds super interesting. People get excited, but you have rules. You cannot just play with customers because you have to be careful with your customers. You cannot just try stuff and see, well, let's see if they do or don't like this.
Yeah.
So I try to do more and more on this within the boundaries of my company. But it's still challenging because, not everything is feasible. How are you going to measure a lot of stuff? Sometimes the technology is not there because your tech stack doesn't allow to do certain experiments. Sometimes you notice that people don't take part in your experiment or actively avoid it. So then your data is biased. So how are you going to solve this? Hmm. So it's a really interesting topic. When you read it in books, it makes a lot of sense. And you can always say there are like some generic behaviors that might apply to a lot of people.
Yeah.
But if you want to investigate it in the context of your company, then you should experiment. And you should experiment a lot. And the most important part in doing your experiment is putting a lot of time and effort in your experimental design.
Yeah.
Because the same thing with software, processing data, garbage in, garbage out. If you have bad experimental design, you get bad outcomes. And if you need to evaluate those and make policy or ideas on this bad design, you have bad policy. So that's a little bit of background of how I started with behavioral science and moving towards actually trying to apply it in my daily job.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I like behavior, and I think I've always enjoyed kind of seeing behavior and seeing it in myself and kind of analyzing it. Why do people do the things they do? Mm-hmm. And where I've really seen it is where I kind of got into the e-commerce domain, where people are trying to optimize conversion, mm-hmm. right? Conversion is an order. When someone places an order or does an action, whatever defined as an action, that means it's good. And we do everything within a funnel. We experiment within a funnel, or we make decisions that change the funnel to kind of push people or to have people behave in the way they want or the way we want them to. Mm-hmm. And usually it's to spend their money. That's what it boils down to. To buy something, if it's a subscription, software as a service, a product at the end of the day, usually that's what it's there for. And in there, I've seen a lot of experimentation, and I've also seen a lot of assumptions where people just don't experiment. And even experiment design, as you've said, when people are experimenting and we've made a bad design on what we're actually experimenting, the data that we're collecting, mm-hmm. usually it's, I wouldn't say it's wasted effort because we're still learning from it, but we have to redo the experiment, basically, because we don't have the data we were looking for. Yeah.
So, and how do you solve this? Because working in a large corporation where you do something, you get like a budget for doing an experiment, then you get certain results. You know that these results might not be as reliable as you think, but how do you get the people around you to accept that you want to redo the experiment to get some proper results?
It's really, I mean, first of all, I try and emphasize on why we do experiments in the first place, right? If the goal is clear, and before doing this experiment, I didn't know we weren't going to have a kind of a clarified answer, mm-hmm. then we still have kind of this undefined answer, right? So if we still want to achieve this goal, we still need the data that kind of contributes towards that. Mm-hmm. And usually that's enough for people to say, okay, we'll redo an experiment, right? And the experiments that we do a lot with A/B testing, where there's not really a lot of costs that's involved there. We basically split the group of users that we have traffic-wise, and then we A/B test versus an old feature or a new feature, basically. Whatever we have now versus whatever we want to introduce or whatever we want to remove. Usually it's introduced because we introduce a lot of stuff, way more than we remove, basically. But yeah, that's I haven't had discussions when it comes to budgets for kind of larger experiments. Mm-hmm. Usually they're on a smaller scale where me or someone from the team can actually fully implement the experiment, and then we can see what the payoff is at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Have you had any kind of experience with budgeting and kind of larger experiments in that way?
Yes, as in that I couldn't get budget.
Yeah.
that was an interesting talk, but then I tried to do like a guerrilla experiment.
Yeah.
The idea was that usually we assume that if A is better than B and B is better than C, that A is also better than C.
Yeah.
So what I tried to do is we did a survey where we compared different features we wanted to add, just small features that you could add to a dashboard to show some information about financials.
Yeah.
And then we asked customers multiple questions, just comparing the two separate features, saying, do you prefer A or do you prefer B? Very simple questions. And my point was that I wanted to show that the preferences of customers are not always consistent.
Mm.
Because everybody's always like, yeah, but if A is doing well, that means that C doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And after doing this research with quite a big group, I saw that while customers would pick A over B and B over C, in a lot of cases, they preferred C over A, which was really confusing. And then I said, you see that you, even though I'm a big fan of experimenting and collecting data, sometimes the data doesn't tell the entire story.
Yeah.
And then we move to interviewing, because I think it's a nice way to enrich your data, because sometimes collecting data shows you what is happening, but it doesn't explain why it is happening.
Exactly.
And then getting some additional data from interviews makes it way more interesting to do experiments, because you can also explain why this decision is made. Because in a vacuum, you would say, yeah, this doesn't make sense because we picked this one over this one. So why would it be circular? And then the interviews made way more sense. So
yeah, right.
gave this extra dimension of knowledge, allowing us to make better decisions on which features should we actually provide to our colleagues. So yeah. that was a lot of fun.
I like that a lot as well. We did interviews as well with one of the kind of e-commerce websites I worked for. And there was like, okay, we start with Google because we're not going to start with our website. They don't even know what it's there for.
Mm-hmm.
Start with Google and we're going to see how we compare to price points and kind of the brand image that a certain company has versus another company. And then they put in the Google search, they do exactly the product that we want them to search. And I was there in the background and the interview process was facilitated through an external company.
Mm-hmm.
And then they see the website that I'm building basically and different more established websites. Like you might say Amazon's in there, Bol's a good kind of Dutch one. And they always go to either Bol or Amazon. They're like, there, I knew it would be cheapest there. Mm-hmm. Well, if you actually look at the price point, ours would be cheaper. But because of the kind of image they have, they would immediately go there. And then it would be, yeah, that's a hard battle. Because then you're kind of already a few points behind. Even if you have a better price point, their kind of default behavior and the brand image they have, it trends them towards the companies that they already go to. And that interview process gave us a lot more insights on, we need to get people also to the website before they even enter the funnel, basically.
Yeah,
which was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because have you ever done interviews yourself?
Yeah, but only in uni.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I did some professional interviews for my company, and it was incredibly difficult.
Mm.
So these interviews were mainly on usability testing. And the hard part is you cannot ask questions that already
no
steering. Push. Yeah, you can't steer. And what made it even more difficult is if you're part of the team that has designed something and you want to test, you're really excited about something.
You're biased as hell.
Yeah. And the hard part is you cannot say like, oh, you should really press the button on the side. And you see the customer struggling like, I don't know what to do next. Yeah. It's like, can you help me? It's like, no.
You decide.
I would love to, but I can't. And it makes it super complicated to do proper interviews. So what we saw when we were doing interviews, that the people who were disconnected from the actual project were most likely to be better interviewers because they had no personal skin in the game.
Yeah.
Because they just wanted to do a good interview and they didn't want to prove that what they have designed is the best thing ever.
Exactly.
Which is hard, because it's also nice to have a chat with somebody who is excited about what they built instead of an indifferent interviewer.
Completely objective and be like, yeah, I don't care. Whatever you pick.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the hardest part is when you see somebody looking at you who is absolutely struggling and asking you for help multiple times and you just can't say anything.
No.
Because that means that there needs to be done something on the flow, because apparently it doesn't make enough sense for the customer to get from A to B on their own.
Yeah.
So it's hard. it's hard, but I think it's super valuable, because it tells you so much more than just making heat maps in the flows you're designing.
Yeah, I agree. Have you kind of had trouble letting go of things that you would think would benefit kind of the flow or conversion or behavior in that way? Because I can give you an example. Like if we're developing features, it can be a generic e-commerce site, right? Someone can have an idea and I can be like, yeah, I can see that. And then, I mean, by coincidence, I'm the person that builds it. And since we're A/B testing, I'm building this thing as fast as possible. It's probably code-wise not the most beautiful, mm-hmm. because I know I might be able to throw it away at the end.
Yep.
And then when it comes out like, oh, it didn't matter, then I'm like, then we remove it. That's it. We don't need it, apparently. Doesn't make a difference. And nowadays, I don't have any trouble throwing away some stuff. I'm like, there. Less is more, basically. But before, if we would work on a feature, let's say for a few days, and then we would put it out, I'd be like, man, I really thought that would help. And I have to throw away all that work, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It gets easier.
Yeah, right.
I think it also has to do with experience and age. Because when I just started working, everything you would do was amazing.
Yeah.
Because you would come out of university, you would have all these ideas and like, I'm going to change the world. And then you start working and then at that point you know, okay, I'm not going to change the world. I'm just happy to make a difference.
Yeah.
And then you have all these amazing ideas. And if you design something or if you have an idea and you try to share it, then you get all these different roadblocks. And in the start, it's really difficult because when you're studying, then every new idea you have and showing that you're proactive is already enough.
Yeah.
The teachers are like, yeah, that's great. Figure it out. But when you start working, you have rules and you have frameworks and you have different departments who have different ideas. And then all of a sudden, all your ideas might not be feasible. And that's really difficult. But after doing multiple projects or writing articles or doing data analysis showing that it doesn't work, at a certain point you learn to accept it. And I think it's just a moment of growth.
But yeah.
Getting there, it was really difficult.
I can imagine. Yeah. I mean, since you touched on it, I just had a conversation with Carlos and he said, organization-wise, there's already by default probably too many processes
mm-hmm.
that kind of kill innovation or creativity, right? And I gave him the example, if you're trying to start building something, a product or anything, you don't take all the processes off the shelf and start working towards those processes. No, you just build, right? You just do whatever you think you do to kind of make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
You don't implement it with processes in mind. And I do feel like, I mean, even how you laid it out, if you come from uni, you go into an organization, by default, there's already a bunch of processes and that might slow you down also. Have you felt kind of similarly about that?
Yes. where to start? I mean, uni is one big sandbox. Everything, yeah. Every idea is worthwhile exploring, unless the idea really doesn't make sense.
Mm.
But you get all this freedom to think about the things you want to do and all the great ideas you have. And then when you start working, you have to deal with certain rules, internal rules, external rules. And that already slows you down in a certain way. On the other hand, giving certain boundaries to what you can do or can't do makes it way more interesting to come up with a nice solution.
Mm.
And I think that's the challenge. So coming up with nice ideas in a vacuum is always, well, I wouldn't want to say easy, but you have all this freedom and you can do whatever you want. But then giving the limited tools you have within your company, try to come up with a solution as nice as you would have in a sandbox environment. And then it becomes way more challenging. But I think that's also super rewarding.
Yeah.
So it was hard, again, in the start to get used to the fact that you have these boundaries. But at a certain point, you see them as, yeah, they can give some guidance in where you can go. Also, I think that companies should give the space to experiment a bit.
Yeah.
Give sandbox environments technically, so you can try some stuff and sometimes maybe do a bit guerrilla and then afterwards check if, okay, the idea that we have, is it actually allowed in the context of our company? Maybe even do research outside of the company without a label.
Yeah.
So then you can just prove that the idea that you have is a really good idea and it has been properly tested, but is it allowed within the confines of our company? So there might be room for growth. I know that a lot of people also like to take their own initiatives and just try stuff.
Mm.
So there's a balance there. I want to motivate them to experiment. But also in my current role, I cannot always allow them to experiment because there are certain rules. So sometimes now I'm limiting people in experimenting and just trying stuff. So that's difficult. I used to be on the other side of the table.
Yeah, I can imagine. I like your perspective, though, that it's more glass half full than half empty in that case, in that it will also result in a lot of fulfillment if you still make it happen, basically. And processes can be seen as boundaries. I mean, I agree with that. I think sometimes there's too many processes, also depending on the organization. But when you then still make it happen, it's probably a great feeling.
Yeah.
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 And good stuff.
And the most powerful thing is that if you do this together with people who are already familiar with the process and you can help them change it and improve it,
yeah,
they're also really happy, because sometimes people consider these processes as the boundaries, but if you can just move them a bit or improve them a bit, I think that's also really nice. It's again easy to introduce something new and say this is completely better, but optimizing what we currently have is also a really nice way of working.
Yeah. I fully advocate for that. If you optimize what you have already, it's kind of tweaking and improving what already runs well, right? If you're looking at what you're kind of good at, usually what you're good at, you can get better at more easily than picking up something you're awful at. Like I can't do any tennis, no padel, no squash, no nothing. If my hand is in a racket and I have a ball, it's awful. I can play football, I can play a little basketball, probably I can get better at those, but starting from behind is harder than improving what is already good.
Yeah, but I do think that, and maybe that's also part of the challenge, right? So when you're done studying, you have the idea that you're an expert on a certain topic and that you want to become better at more things, that you widen your profile, that you become more of a generalist. And then as you start working more and more, it makes more sense to move to being a specialist, because it's really hard to differentiate, to show what you're really good at. And then in the past, I always used to challenge myself, having the feeling that, yes, I'm really good at this part of my job, but I should really get better at this part of my job. Mm. And it was really difficult getting better, as you said. But at a certain point, I noticed that it's better for everyone if I start leveraging my talents more than trying to become better at the things I'm not really good at. And yeah, that was a nice realization, because you also can use your personal talents more and maybe the things you enjoy more, and don't focus too much on, okay, you might not be the best public speaker, but do you want to be a public speaker? No, but it's expected from you. Okay, is that really the case? Maybe you should discuss this with your mentor or your manager, because it's nicer that you feel good in your job and doing the things you like and the things you're good at than challenging you on stuff you're not good at while you don't even want to grow in that part anyways.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can do it. You can probably do it. I think you can do, if you set your mind to it, find a routine, get better at public speaking, for example, even if you don't have the aptitude for it, but you have to want to do it. Otherwise, it's never going to happen, right? You can force it with discipline, people that are very disciplined, but then you're still forcing it. Like, it doesn't make sense if you don't find enjoyment in it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
When it comes to conversion, I had this thought leading into this conversation, because I think some companies might completely overdo conversion optimization as well and kind of changing behavior. And I have an example that we've tried HelloFresh, right? We got like a coupon in the email that said, oh, you get a bunch of boxes for a lot of lower amount, probably half what you pay normally. But then on the website, I can't cancel my subscription anywhere. I have to call customer service or open up a chat box, and they can only cancel for me. So companies have now made it super easy for me to subscribe to something, and it made it very difficult to get rid of that subscription completely. And when it seems like I've canceled, no, I still have a box that arrives somehow at my doorstep the next week. Like, I feel like companies can very much overdo it now as well when it comes to conversion optimization.
Yeah, but it's costly to get you as a customer, right? So giving you boxes half off costs them a lot of money. So from a business perspective, I understand why they make certain decisions.
Yeah.
As a person, I find it really annoying.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so sometimes you have the subscription and I'm like, okay, I want to get rid of the subscription. And you go to your profile page and then it's like, oh, your subscriptions or payments, and you go there and it's like, oh, you want to cancel? Please contact our customer service. And you send an email to a customer service, you never get a response.
Yeah.
You try to find a phone number. The phone number is somewhere hidden on the website. So getting you hooked is quite easy now because they offer you all these nice things to become a customer. But getting rid of the company is becoming more and more challenging.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's too much. So it's too much. They make it way too complicated. On the one hand, they try to profile themselves as being customer focused. We want to do optimal customer service. However, we're impossible to reach.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then maybe the two customers that can actually speak to you, they get excellent service, which is nice. But the other 90 customers that are still trying to find your phone number, they might not get the customer service that they want.
Yeah.
So in that respect, I sometimes think that customers are focused too much on obtaining customers and maintaining them or keeping them in a bad way instead of just being a good company.
Yeah.
And it's easy for me to say as an individual because I don't have my own company. But as a consumer, sometimes I feel like, yeah, you're just trying to trick me into buying something or staying with you instead of actually providing me something awesome, why I want to be a customer with you.
Yeah, and I feel like the hard part to measure is kind of brand damage, right? Reputational damage. And because it like leaves a sour taste in my mouth, I talk about it. I'm like, I like HelloFresh. I don't like kind of their service though. I can't get rid of it. I like the boxes. I like the concepts. I think it's too expensive. I mean, I'm also Dutch, like can do cheaper. And then I want to cancel and I cannot cancel. Like the brand damage from that, I don't know how much that is. It's probably hard for me to say how to quantify it. And I don't know if that's kind of a known decision on their front, that what they do, kind of the behavior that they create or making it really hard to cancel something might also leave reputational damage, basically. Do organizations go that far, you think, in their decision-making and why do they implement the things they do?
You would expect it, right? That they would at least consider the fact that, okay, if we do this promotion, 7 out of 10 customers are okay with it. They might get stuck and some of them are a bit annoyed, but 3 out of 10 are maybe super annoyed with us. And they have their own network and they spread the fact that they're not super happy with it. You would expect that they would take this into consideration because I had a really bad experience with a telecom provider in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And I will never be a customer of them again. Never. Even though if they would offer their services free, I wouldn't even become a customer.
Yeah, principally.
Exactly. And it just had to do with the fact that when I had a subscription with them, where I used to live was a blind spot on their coverage map. So I couldn't get service at home, which was really annoying. And then I called them and they had like this clause saying that, okay, if you are in a blind spot, then we can break open your subscription and you can move to a different company where you don't have this issue.
Yeah.
So it's something that they offer apparently. And it was really difficult to break open my subscription and move to a different provider, even though it's something that apparently they offer.
Yeah.
So at that point, when I finally closed the contract, I called their customer service again and explained the situation and saying, I'm never, ever going to be a customer of you ever again. No matter how good of a deal you will provide me, it will not happen.
Yeah, it's done.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people in my proximity got affected by it because I was complaining a lot, which might not always be as fair. But yeah, I was really frustrated. And when they ask like, oh, we consider this provider, would you consider them? Never.
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 Yeah.
And I'll tell the story and they're like, oh, I never want to experience this. You will most likely not experience it because if you check their coverage map,
it's quite good.
Yeah, yeah, and the probability that you are in a blind spot is really small. But what if it happens?
Yeah,
yeah, just what if? And then you see that people avoid these like big risks with really small probabilities.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, what if that happens? Yep.
Then you're an outlier.
Yeah, but if you're just thinking about it doesn't make sense. You can check it up front on the website. But still people are like, yeah, but what if? It's always difficult to take these really low probability, high risk chances into your mind.
Yeah.
Think about the lottery, that even though we know that the probability that you win the lottery is super duper small, a lot of people have the feeling that if you buy the tickets at the end of the year, it's like this is going to be it. This is the year. Next year, I'll say goodbye to my boss. I'll buy a home somewhere in South Africa, live between the lines. I don't know, but this is the year. Even though deep inside, we all know that it's most likely not going to happen.
Never gonna happen.
Yeah, it's really, really complicated. But maybe it's a combination of like bad judgment combined with hope.
It could be.
Yeah, that you just have some things that you want to get rid of or want to improve in your life, and then putting in a lot of effort to getting it done is difficult, but winning the lottery would be a really nice way to just bypass all the
work.
Yeah, all the hard stages. It's like, just take the elevator. This is it. Yeah, you're done.
Yeah. Let me take the elevator to South Africa. That's hilarious. Yeah, I think it's... I was going to send you this before this conversation, actually, but I forgot to do it because I knew we were going to talk, get into behavior and especially conversion in that way. But there was an interesting article I saw. It's about a company called Blender. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly what services they provide, but let's say they're a SaaS company. I know that for sure. And they made their subscription as easy as possible to cancel. You could find it everywhere. You don't want this anymore. Cancel here. Done. Few clicks. You're done. You're out. And otherwise, it would be monthly subscription. And I talked to the girl that, because I was going to do a podcast episode with her, can't do it because she's remote and I only do people in person now. But regardless, she said she advocated for that. She had to pitch it. Everyone was against it, but she really leveraged the data showing that it was going to benefit the company. It was going to optimize conversion even more. And I think their conversion increased substantially by quite a lot, by making it as easy as possible to cancel. And it goes into every human judgment there is. Everyone's like, make it cancel. That doesn't make any sense. Probably they were like, don't you see what HelloFresh is doing? It's nowhere to be found. And when I read the article, I was like, okay. Apparently, people also appreciate it, I guess. I don't know. If it's cancelable effortlessly, maybe they take the subscription more easily, I guess. How do you say that? Rationally, I would say no, that would never work. But then the data shows that it actually does work, and in practicality, it also works. Apparently, we can also do good things with our data.
Yeah, for me, in a sense, it does seem like a really good solution, because now we as consumers are aware of the fact that it's really hard to get rid of subscriptions.
Yeah.
So not making it difficult to get rid of your subscription can become a unique selling point compared to the past, where everybody would make it easy to get rid of a subscription. And then smart companies would take advantage of the fact that, yeah, if we can send you into this maze, we can keep you as a customer for a few extra months.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really clever idea to turn around what we have considered to be normal and provide good customer service and be rewarded for it. I think it's really cool.
Do you think that happens often? Because I was talking to this about with Carlos as well, just previously, and we were talking about the YouTube recommendation algorithm, right? It's awesome. YouTube recommends you whatever you want to watch, or whatever you've watched, or content that is similar to that. But then when you just want a fresh perspective, or kind of, how do you say that, discover things, the recommendation system is all of a sudden against you. And now companies are spinning up, and one of their USPs is, we don't have the YouTube recommendation system. It's like something that's going well and people are getting frustrated with that part. And then another company spins up and their USP is like, we're not that. We don't do that. Or we do the opposite of that.
Wow.
I feel like it's kind of similar to where companies are really good with their service. They make the cancelable thing really hard to do. And then there's a company that makes it effortless. And all of a sudden people are like, yeah, that's what I want now.
Yeah.
Have you seen that as well in other things?
Wow. To be honest, I really don't know.
No, right?
No, it's nice design. And especially with stuff like social media platforms, those are designed to keep you engaged as much as possible.
Yeah.
And you notice it wherever you're walking or anywhere you are in the world right now, as soon as somebody's bored for like a microsecond, they take their phone out of their bag, excuse me, and yeah, they start scrolling.
Yeah.
And then sometimes I'm like, yeah, I don't even have a feeling anymore of what type of content I'm consuming because it's just so random. But apparently it's completely catered to me because you keep scrolling.
Yeah.
So it's like this malicious design to keep people hooked to your application and then in between splice some apps in the hope that they will buy something.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, from a business perspective, it makes a lot of sense. But as a human, I wouldn't want to make something like that because, yeah, you want to let people do things they like because they like it and not because they're hooked to your platform.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it would have been nice if more companies would move towards a different system where they're really looking at how can we make customers happy instead of getting them hooked. But apparently it just works because it keeps on working. You see it in social media platforms. You see it in game design that microtransactions, even though you wouldn't think that people would spend a few hundred euros on a game, that there are these whales who spend thousands upon thousands of euros on a single game.
Yeah.
It wouldn't make sense in your mind. Like, how can I convince somebody to spend thousands of euros to have like a silly hat in a game? I don't know. But apparently it works. So why move away from something that works? You need to take additional risk with no certain reward, and you cannot leverage existing knowledge on how to get people hooked. So I think it's super brave. If companies take these risks, design new stuff to make people happy, and they earn money with it, I'm totally fine with it. I think it's really nice.
Yeah. Do you have an example of like a company that has done that? Because if you don't, I can name one, which I saw recently, actually.
Maybe you can start. Yeah. So give me some time to think.
Have you played Pokemon Go? Now, the Pokemon game came out with a new, the Pokemon company came out with a new game. I don't know if it's Game Freak still, but it's called Pokemon Sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the game rewards you in like in-game currency or whatever based on the amount of sleep that you have. So it shows you like which Pokemon you slept and you get items. And with those items, you can probably get Pokemon. I haven't played the game. I just read this stuff and people are sleeping more. And then I'm like, people sleeping more. That's a good thing. And this game apparently rewards you for the more you sleep. Now people overdo it because people are taking sleeping pills to kind of to sleep more, to get more items and stuff like that. So it can also be harmful in that way. But this game leverages something that you should do, basically, and rewards you for it with in-game currency. Like, it's completely gamified sleeping. If you love Pokemon, you have a terrible sleep schedule, you download this game, you try to be good at this game, you'll probably sleep better. I love that concept, basically. I think that's awesome.
Maybe we should have told Ash, so you become a Pokemon master when you sleep more instead of in the woods. Yeah, I think it's really nice. So you saw the same thing with Pokemon Go. At the start, everybody was walking outside and connecting, and it was really nice. But then what always happens is people start gaming the system because, yeah, I could have like a 10-kilometer walk to go to these Pokestops and collect these items, or I could put my phone on my record player and put it in motion so my GPS thinks I'm moving so I can game the system. And then it's like, yeah, but where's the reward then?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, you can also bypass a lot of stuff just by paying. And then the question is like, where do you get the reward from this game?
Mm.
Is it from the fact that you go outside, connect to people, feel healthier because you get more sunlight because you exercise? Or from the fact that you have enough stuff in your backpack so you can catch as many Pokemon as you want. So
yeah,
it's a balance. And I think there's something to say for both of them. So if people want to pay for certain services within games or platforms, I think they should be able to do so. However, it shouldn't reduce how much other people can benefit from the platform or that game. So cosmetics in video games, I think they're fine because they don't affect the gameplay.
Yeah.
They don't reduce the fun you can have as a non-paying customer. But if you start offering power-ups or different stuff, different weapons, whatever, for payment, then you're giving an advantage to the people who are paying money. And I think that's bad design because you're just focusing on your paying customers. And then maybe if you would have these cosmetics, then sometimes you can convince a customer who isn't paying, like, okay, I think this company is doing something nice. I will pay some money to help this company to stay afloat,
yeah,
instead of being forced into needing to buy something. You see a lot of malicious design tricks when it comes to getting people to pay something in, for example, mobile games.
Yeah.
So apparently when you want to buy something in a mobile game, then you get this pop-up from your phone saying, do you actually want to allow this game to make a transfer for you so you can do in-game purchases? But if you do one purchase, then the next time you don't get the pop-up anymore. Mm. So like this hurdle to actually buy something becomes a lot lower.
Yeah.
Because the first time they do like this super awesome discounted package where you just need to pay 99 cents. And you're like, okay, I get a really good deal for the 99 cents. But that's only their investment to get you into the paying customer pool.
Exactly.
And then it becomes easier because when you're sitting on the couch late in the evening and you're like, yeah, maybe I should buy it. You can buy it with one click. It becomes a lot more difficult to resist the urge to start buying,
yeah,
because you don't have this feedback anymore from like, hey, do you actually want to purchase this anymore? So it's smart. It's really smart design, but it's also, yeah, I think it's kind of evil.
Yeah, is it ethical, basically? Yeah, probably not. They do it right when your currency runs out as well. Your resources are out. You're like, oh, I'm done. Then the thing pops up. It's like a good deal.
Yeah. Like, and they have like this layers of currency stacked onto each other to make it even more complicated. So if I want to buy this, I have to pay in diamonds and then I have to buy some silver links and then buy another currency and then I can buy the item. So
yeah,
at a certain point, you don't know the monetary value of this item anymore. It's like, did I pay 17 euros for a digital hat?
Yeah. After the currency conversion.
Yeah, exactly. You need like an Excel spreadsheet to keep track of how much money you spend on this particular hat.
Yeah.
Again, it's really smart design because the added complexity just deters people from thinking about how much they spend. But yeah, is it ethical? Is it nice to trick people into spending more on things they might not need?
Yeah.
And exactly. I think that's an interesting debate.
Yeah, that's a hard one. I mean, especially in gaming, sometimes companies are labeled as evil because they make certain rates or certain, it's usually rates too low, or like the things are too pricey, or the game is too hard for people that don't spend any money. But then people still love the game, play the game. They just hate the company that makes the game. Like, it's a weird dynamic in gaming, honestly, what I've seen. It's a funny thing because I did my thesis I did on free-to-play app games and exactly what incentivizes people to purchase stuff in free games, basically. And a big factor there was exactly as you said, you have to be able to play the game as is without paying. That's one of the biggest contributors to people actually then taking the step and making a payment and purchasing an item in the first place. So that's the baseline, basically. The game needs to be playable. And then probably within the game, they can facilitate certain behavior and experiment in that way. When your stuff runs out, maybe a pop-up helps, or when there's more people that are already paying and they interact with each other, I don't know what happens. But I feel like companies leverage then a lot of that data throughout kind of being more aware of behavior and like customers manipulating consumer behavior and stuff like that, nudging, sludging, all that. Are you more like aware of when a company is doing it? It can be in a game, can be not in a game, can be in marketing, communication, anything.
So sometimes, at the start, you're not really familiar with the tricks they're pulling or the smart ways they have to convince you to buy something. I know that I have some weaknesses. So sometimes I put books in my shopping cart.
Yeah.
Many books. Even though I already have a huge reading list and I have books stacked at home, knowing, okay, I still have to read these books, but people tell me, oh, this is really an amazing book. It's for your work, it can be amazing for your personal life, so you should read it. Okay,
yeah.
Put it in my shopping cart. And then sometimes you get this reminder, it's like, hey, we found something in your shopping cart.
Always.
Do you, did you lose it? It's like, no, I didn't lose it.
Did you this forget it? Yeah. It's like that one.
Yeah, it was intentional. I wanted to put it there because maybe I want to buy it. And then when I move it to like a favorites list, it disappears forever. Because then in a year, I'll look in the favorites list and it's like, yeah, I don't know who told me about this book anymore. So then it just disappears.
Gone.
Yeah, it's gone. But sometimes I just have these impulse by... Because the company knows that at a certain point, like maybe they know when I usually buy stuff like this. So they send me the reminder at the exact time that they know, like I know that they can trigger me into actually buying it. So that's a difficult one for me. It's like they know that you're hurt, so we can get them then. But on the other hand, you know that if companies offer you something really nice for really low price to get you on board, or to they give you a major discount, then usually it has to do with the fact that either they just want to get me on board and then afterwards it becomes more expensive, or this company doesn't earn money with the fact that they sell something besides my data.
Yeah.
And what's tricky about that is, so Google has this really nice feature where you have a Gmail account, you can add a plus in your Gmail with a small extension. So I usually add the name of that company where I'm subscribing in my email account. Mm. And when I subscribe for something or I buy something there, afterwards I can see if I get emails from different companies on that email account, I know, okay, that company is selling my information.
Yeah.
So I'm never going to buy there again. And it happens quite a lot. And it makes it easy to track, but it's also... Yeah, it's not nice to see that a lot of companies are doing it. So
it's like administration. It's administrative work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do know that, okay, some companies can be trusted and some can't be. So I try to avoid them. But you don't know this up front. It's not like I'm going to look on review websites or Reddit to check, hey, is this company going to sell my data? I don't know. But I really dislike the fact that they try to sell you a nice product at a nice rate. And you're like, okay. It seems like just one transaction. I pay you some money, you give me a nice product.
Give me the thing.
But apparently, I give them some money and my personal information, which is being sold, so they double dip. They can earn money on me twice while I'm not aware of it, which I think is, it's not great that we're moving in this direction more and more.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I don't want to give my data either. So then when I have to, I'll be like, nah. I'm not going here, and now I'll try and do it somewhere else where I don't have to. Like it's become a hurdle where I know it's going to happen. I don't want to get any other email from other companies, basically. I don't sell my data. So then I go to an option where I don't have to do that, or I have to do like the bare minimum, which again is being used as a USP, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, you see it more and more. Eh? You can, continue as a guest. You don't have to subscribe. It's like, that's... Sometimes it's really nice because, I don't have to provide my information, but still like their personal environment where you can check your orders or maybe order the stuff you have ordered again, then it's nice to have this environment of that company where you can see your previous orders and what you've paid. So it makes it difficult because sometimes it is actually beneficial to become a member or to give your information. But the only downside is, please don't sell it.
No.
Because I don't want you to sell my information, or at least tell me about it in a font larger than 2. That would also be nice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the funniest things is I went to your XKE, like the one you gave a few weeks back. Must have been a little bit more than a month. Mm-hmm. And you showed me this picture about like the walkways in London that says like, look right, basically. And then I went to London. I was there a few weeks back and I just looked at the road. And I was like, yeah. If this wasn't there, like it's so like the opposite world where people drive, like I needed the reminders everywhere to kind of change my default patterns to look for cars on the opposite side of the road. That was hilarious, I must say. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that is, again, I think really good design because it is only made with the idea to help people.
Yeah.
So giving people the reminder that you need to look right, I think, before they cross the road, it's a nice safety measure. People are always looking down because they're watching on their phone. So it makes a lot of sense to put a reminder on the floor. I think it's awesome design.
Yeah.
And I think as mentioned before, it even takes less paint.
Exactly.
Than a huge white square. So it's great design. And you have more and more like these ideas where they actually try to help people to make better decisions, to improve themselves. But the hard part is because a lot of companies are trying to abuse the fact that you make certain decisions by default or the way you act on habits, that it becomes difficult for other companies to also help you in a certain way. Because if you're constantly pushed around by all these impulses, then it becomes really hard to find a direction in which you want to go. So at a certain point, if you're, if you have all these impulses around you, how are you going to make a decision? Is this actually good? Is this trustworthy? It makes it super complicated. And then things like crossing a road in London, it gives me hope.
Yeah.
Because it shows that, people can do really nice things with behavioral design. Just make something nice to help people to not get hit by a bus. Awesome.
Yeah. I feel like the things you see in cities and stuff like that, that influence behavior. Like I've seen stuff like people walking up the stairs and it's like a gamified thing, or it's like, looks like a piano. The things on a piano. I don't know what you call
the
those
keys.
In English. The keys. Yeah, my goodness. It's late. If it looks like the keys of a piano, or if it makes a jingle, then although some people do it. And I feel like the ones that are in cities usually benefit like good behavior. And the ones that are in software usually benefit either a company or like a monetary value is what I've seen. Probably because software related wise, it's easier to experiment with it. They can do so many multiple iterations and they can really optimize it. Whereas in a city, you do it and you're probably not going to do it again. It's going to be there. And if it's not 100%, if it's like 75%, you're like, still good.
Yep.
Move on to the next thing.
Yeah. And it's, if you want to do multiple experiments, for example, at a train station, if you're going to exchange the steps every 2 weeks, people will get annoyed.
Absolutely.
So it's really difficult to replicate the results of your previous experiments. And that makes it difficult. Also, sometimes experiments can completely backfire if they want to get you to start moving more. I showed you the example with the stairway showing how much calories you burn for every step. And in a sense, it makes, you would think that people get motivated to exercise more. Hey, you walk up the stairs and see, hey, how many calories have I burned when I walk up the stairs?
Yeah.
Especially when you're out of shape. If you walk up a flight of stairs and you're out of breath and you know, like this was like half a calorie, I'm super demotivated.
Yeah.
Because you know, if you already take a glance at a cookie, you have like gained 50 or 60 calories. So it's nice design. The intention is really good, but it can also completely backfire because it demotivates people from taking the stairs because they consider it, it's quite a lot of effort, but the benefit is so small. And then it's difficult to explain, but the intention is good. They want to get you to exercise more. And on the other hand, if you're designing stuff like this, it doesn't change the way the habits of people are. Mm. So getting them to do things once or twice is cool.
Yeah.
But forming habits, so actually become healthier, actually exercise more, is way more difficult. So do something 6 weeks in a row instead of once or twice is way more challenging. And it's hard. It's hard to get people to form better habits.
Yeah.
So if you want to design something, you can always show your results. Hey, when we changed the stairs, we saw that 20 or 40% more people took the stairway. Awesome. Is this effect still there after 2 or 3 weeks when like the funny part of your talking stairs is gone, or when a part of the paint is already gone because of the decay that people walking up or down the stairs? So having consistent results with your behavioral design is even more challenging and interesting than just having this one-off beneficial effect.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, the funny thing is I was trying to compare why stuff that is more physical is always trying to adapt kind of behavior. Because if I see something like in London, look right on the floor and cars are coming from the left side instead of the right side, what I'm used to, then at some point I'll adapt my behavior, right? I'll always do that. I might not even look at the floor anymore. I know it's going to come from that side. So then my behavior has changed completely. Like, it's become a habit for me to look the other way. If I go to my home country again, I'm going to have to adapt if I've lived a few years in London. And I feel like online, digitally, it's not really about changing habits too much. I think maybe gaming companies and like spending money, that's maybe the only part where I'm like, okay, they're trying to make it a habit for you to spend money more frequently. But usually it's like a one-off transaction where companies are trying to make one-off purchases. And sure, recurring purchases are good, but those are not necessarily as much the goal as kind of those one-offs. I feel like in-person design, city design and behavioral design in that way is more lent towards changing behavior, like habitual behavior, rather than like a one-off thing in that way.
Yeah, I think you make an amazing point. And I think it also has to do with the fact that the people who work for the municipality want to help the people that live in their city.
Exactly.
And they don't benefit from gaming their citizens because, no. Yeah, they want to have a nice city. So you see that also on a government level in the Netherlands, you have like this behavioral design department. Mm. And there are a lot of people thinking about how can we help people make better decisions? And they can be on large scale, but they can also be on a small scale. And I think it's nice. I think it's good that we leverage the fact that we know that some people make certain decisions by default. There's also a really nice book on it. It's called Choosing Not to Choose. Mm. So the idea is that sometimes it's better for people to not make a decision. You should let an expert make that decision for them. If you go to the doctors and the doctor always lays out certain options for you and you always have to make the decision on your own, it makes it super complicated. This person is the expert, so he or she should tell me,
yeah,
this is the best treatment for you. This can also help, but I would prefer you to do this. So in that sense, sometimes I think that policymakers should take into account more, we shouldn't always give people the freedom to choose, because sometimes the things are things people don't want to think about, like your retirement.
Yeah.
It's super complicated. Like the financials is complicated. Thinking about stuff 30 or 40 years in the future, super complicated. It's already complicated to think about, okay, what's going to happen next year and what can happen in the meantime? I mean, who would have predicted that a few years ago, all of a sudden we would be in a lockdown, yeah, and we would have a worldwide pandemic? So thinking about stuff happening further and further into the future makes things more abstract, more complicated. And then why should you give people a lot of options on choosing, on saving for retirement and thinking about how they should tackle this while you have a lot of experts thinking about this? And policymakers can leverage this more. So thinking about, is this something that everybody should have an opinion about, or is this something an expert should make a decision in?
Yeah.
And in some cases, I prefer experts to make a decision.
I can imagine so. The problem is when that happens and it's a wrong decision, people lose faith and lose trust quickly. That's the only pitfall. And once that faith and trust is gone, it's even harder to get it back. And then they want to make all the decisions themselves all of a sudden. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out, like, I love the doctor example because, yeah, the doctor gives me options. I have a good example, basically. And this is where I chose for myself because I had to pull all my wisdom teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And I postponed it. I don't like going to the doctor. I postponed it for so long until I had a hole in one of my wisdom teeth. And I was like, fine, they can fix it now. But because they're hard to, like, they're very much in the back, it's hard to brush them. So holes are bound to happen. And I went to the doctor and I said, can we pull all of them in one go? And they were like, we don't advise that at all. No, make a appointment at the hospital. You get them pulled on each side, basically, right side, then left side. So then I made my appointment with the jaw surgeon. I went to the guy, I said, can you pull all of them? He was like, we don't advise that, blah, blah, blah. I said, but can you do it? He's like, I can do it. So you want me to do it? I was like, I think so. And then all of a sudden I was there. I was sedated completely. I was like, here we go. We're going to do all of them right now. I don't have to go back a second time. That was basically my goal, where everyone advised me not to do it. And I decided I want to do it. And I'm happy I did because I didn't have to go back. But yeah, it sucked for a few hours.
Yeah, and then you're lucky.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people have like jaw aches for, yeah, several days, maybe even weeks. And then if you're like your entire face is bloated for multiple weeks and you can't eat anything.
That's the reason.
Yeah, then it doesn't make a lot of sense. So I know from experience, so my little sister had the same.
Yeah.
She wanted to do all four at the same time. The doctor said, please don't do it. She said, I really want to do it because I hate going there.
Yeah.
And I saw her struggling for like 10 days. She couldn't eat anything and it was a nightmare. So when I had to take them out, I was like, no,
side, please.
Just one side. But yeah, going to the hospital, stuff like that, is, for me, it's always really scary. So that's like a bad habit of me. If I know that I need to go to the dentist or to the doctor, I try to postpone it because for me, you have like the scala of options of all the bad things that can happen. So as long as I don't go to the doctor, those bad things don't happen.
Yeah.
And I tried to change that. So I had a time where like the last years of uni, I wouldn't go to the dentist as much because I wasn't happy with my dentist, but I always had the feeling that I would have a cavity after I went to the dentist. So I tried to postpone my appointments. And then afterwards, I got some issues, like minor issues. But those were far worse than doing the checkup.
Yeah.
So, and then I started realizing, yeah, maybe I should change my habit. So if I feel pain somewhere or I detect something strange, maybe I should actually go to the doctor instead of being stubborn and think, yeah, as long as I nothing. Don't know, yeah. There's nothing there.
Well, you don't know, it doesn't harm you.
Exactly. It's like, oh, it'll grow back. It'll be fine. It's like stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. It, in Dutch culture, it's like, oh, take a paracetamol and it'll go over. Even when you go to the doctor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The doctor tells you the same. It's like, yeah, my mom already said it.
Yeah.
Paracetamol and that's we're done.
Yeah. Dutch culture. Dutch doctor culture. This was a lot of fun, man. Was this kind of what you expected going into this?
No, I would think that it would take a lot longer.
A lot longer?
Yeah. I had a feeling like, oh, we're in the middle of the conversation. And I could go on for a few hours because I'm having a blast.
That's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. To be honest, I was kind of nervous because I'm not familiar with having a microphone and having headphones on where you can have feedback of your own voice, which is something I really need to get used to. But it was a really nice way of having conversations. I think it's really cool.
Good stuff, man. Thanks a lot. This was a lot of fun. I'm going to round it off here. I'm going to put all Shores' socials in the description below. Check them out. Let them know you came from our show. And with that being said, thank you for listening. We'll see you in the next one.